Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere Lombardi Edition, Developing for Performance and Scalability. Today's presenter is David Parrish. David has 6 years' experience as a WebSphere Lombardi Edition Teamwork Support Engineer specializing in performance. At this point in time, I would like to turn the presentation over to David.
Joseph, thank you very much. As you mentioned, my name is David Parrish, and today we're going to talk about how to write applications, specifically BPDs and services, that perform in WLE in such a way that they're very fast and very scalable. We're going to be demonstrating not just list patterns for performance, but actually a number of anti-patterns to avoid, some of them quite common when doing development. So, Joseph, let's go ahead and get started and move on to slide 2, please. Today, what we're going to be talking about are execution context, heap and never-ending services, long-running BPDs, multi-instance loops, conditional joins, error handling, coach performance, system lane activities, Java integrations, WLE console tools, and tasks in the inbox. Slide 3, please. Execution context. First and foremost, what is execution context? Execution context is the variables that are maintained while running a service or a BPD. So if you've got a variable tw.local.myvar, then that variable and its scope is the execution context. Understandably, maintaining very large variables is expensive. There are two main reasons for that. One, the database cost is very high because when you need to save that execution status, it can take time. And also, heap cost is very, very high. So if you've got a large variable that's got, you know, a very large database result set that's returned, if you keep that variable around then and you try to run 100 instances of that service, then you're going to run into heap issues because they're all being stored in memory while they're being executed. Execution context saves happen in more places than you might actually realize. One of the big ones is when you're moving from the BPD engine to the service engine and back again. So if you've got an activity with an output variable that's a megabyte worth of data, right, when that activity completes and we transition from the service engine to the BPD engine, we have to save the execution context for the service and then load it back in again for the BPD. We also do an execution context save inside the service at every single coach and at any point where the save execution context is checked in the diagram. So why do we save execution context, particularly while you're moving within a service? It does make sense when you've got to go from the service to the BPD intuitively because you're moving from one engine state to the next and you need to pass the data back and forth. We save execution context so that if you have to rerun the task will start up at the last successful save execution context point. So it's an excellent way if you've got to retrieve a bunch of data from a database and the user gets to a coach. Since we save the execution context at the coach, if the customer closes the coach and then comes back and restarts the task, it won't redo all that preamble work. It'll go straight to the coach. So how do you reduce the amount of execution context that is being saved? Well, it's actually quite simple, and it's just a normal programming construct, and that is when you're not done with the variable, null it out. Next slide for a simple example here. This is an example of where the execution context is actually being saved. So if you look at the what's in yellow there, the server script that's in this example, it has save execution context saved. There was a time where it was actually checked by default, but I believe as of 7.1 and 7.2, it is no longer checked by default. But it is worth checking on your solution to go through and see if you're saving it to make sure that it's not impacting you much. I've seen cases where having this checked all over the place can make the difference between a service that runs over a step 1,000 times taking 30 seconds and taking half a second. It's rather significant. Next slide, please. Heap and never-ending services. So we're on slide 5 at the moment. This relates a lot to execution context. A very common pattern for writing a service is to write a service that never ends. And a very good example of that would be a customer runs a report, and then when they're done with the report, and the report's inside a service, inside a coach, they'll close the browser, and the service will effectively be canceled, or you'll have what I like to call an index service, where its job is to bring up a list of tasks that you're doing in some custom way. So you're not using the web API, you're doing it inside a service itself, and that service never actually goes to an endpoint. It just, they, you know, you keep refreshing the screen by clicking a button, or the user just X's out of the service and closes the service. The problem with that is that the service engine is actually a stateful session bean. And stateful session beans are held by the app server waiting for a response from the user. And until the bean gets to a point where it either completes or fails, that bean stays in the cache. The default timeout for that cache is 2 hours. And you really don't, and that, so your first answer is usually, well, let's just shorten that cache. But it turns out shortening that is a really bad idea, because you don't want to have the bean timeout before the web session timeout. And services are executed in the TeamWorks web app. So just as an aside here, you've got a Portal web app by default, and you've got a TeamWorks web app, and they each have their own web session timeouts. Well, you want to make sure that none of those get tripped on you before the bean, or have the bean timeout before the web session timeout. So it turns out that solving this problem is just a derivative of using lower execution context, and that is, when you're done with a variable, null it out. The difference is, when you're done with a variable here, you're not stopping at a server script. So how do you display the data and yet still null it out? The way that you do that is to actually null it out in a custom HTML block. And we've got an example we'll look at here in just a moment. But there's actually a tech note that describes this. So if you go to our to the WebSphere tech notes page and pull in that number, you'll be able to see the tech note. Look at slide 6. This is a very simple example here where we've got a coach that, in this example, it's an XML result set. So you may be querying the database for a whole bunch of data and then displaying it on the coach. And we just have a custom HTML block that's effectively at the bottom of the coach that nulls out these variables. And since it's at the bottom and it's a custom HTML block, it's evaluated at the end, and you can null out the variables. And in this scenario, even though this service doesn't complete, because the user may not click on OK or cancel, they may close the browser, or maybe OK loops back to the same coach. Even though it doesn't complete, since the variables are nulled out, the amount of data that's being held for the service is very small. I mean, in fact, I think it's less than 4K. So you can have hundreds of them, and it won't affect you any. So let's move on to slide 7. Another interesting anti-pattern are long-running BPDs, particularly those that are polling for additional data. So if a BPD is designed to run forever, so it'll have a step where you start it, and then it goes to a message event waiting to receive a message, gets the message, does some processing, and loops back in back to the message. That doesn't actually burn CPU forever, but what it does do is cause the auto tracking to pile up, because what you end up with is a lot of nested tracking groups, and there's some cases where that can cause some memory issues on the performance server. Another interesting byproduct of using a BPD that effectively would run forever is that if that BPD ever fails, it actually could be kind of hard to restart it, because you had written it so that it's supposed to run forever. So if you do see yourself writing a BPD that you see looping forever and ever on some waiting on a polling in a polling pattern, consider instead having an external system call into TeamWorks and advance it that way, particularly if it needs to create a new instance or something. But it just tends to work a little bit better, and you also get a more immediate response, because the BPD or BPDs will get kicked off when they're supposed to, instead of when they're actually at the polling point and are ready to advance. Now, if you do need to have long-running BPDs, that's perfectly okay. In fact, we've had customers that have instances that last for years. But in those scenarios, it's a good idea to try to make it so that if there is a failure, you can restart the BPD and get it back to the same point. So a very common pattern for that is to store some of the data in a system of record, and you can basically start a new instance that reads from that system of record and get you started back up again, and then also turn off auto-tracking. You can use an explicit tracking group if you want, but you may want to turn off auto-tracking to avoid the problem with nested tracking points. Slide number 8, please. Another interesting pattern I see every once in a while is using BPDs for batch processing. That's perfectly okay, because you need to go to the BPD layer if you need to do messaging. But if you don't need to do messaging, where you need to wait for a message event or something like that. You're actually better off having your system-to-system stuff be encapsulated into one service with, you know, kind of lots and lots of nested services underneath that. Think of the BPD layer as being for process problems and those that need human interaction and messaging. But if you actually need to just do some system-to-system thing, it's better off to keep that in the service engine. And we'll cover that a little bit more detail when we talk about sequential system lanes a little bit further on in the presentation. Slide 9, please. Multi-instance loops. So multi-instance loops is an implementation in the activity that allows you to spawn tasks in parallel. And before I cover this in a lot of detail, we should talk a little bit about how the BPD engine runs and works. The BPD engine is a very, very much a highly parallel engine, but it can only advance one token per instance at a time. So if you have 100 instances of a BPD, we can run all 100 at once, but if each of those instances have 10 tokens, we can only do one token per instance at a time. Now, how does that relate to a multi-instance loop? Well, be careful when using sub-BPDs as the activity of a multi-instance loop, because when you do that, what you end up doing is spawning additional tokens. And so you can run into a scenario where if you have a BPD instance that has a sub-BPD that spawns 1,000 tasks, that means 1,000 instances. That means 1,000 tokens. And so that means that you can only advance one token per instance at a time. It can take a very long time for that multi-instance loop to complete. The other thing that you should be careful about is a multi-instance loop should not be used to attempt to execute batch or system lane activities. Basically, multi-instance loops are really designed for user tasks, right? And user tasks are generally, it's an activity that is a service that, so the you spawn 1,000 tasks and the users get them in their inbox and they complete them sort of in a random, asynchronous, not really high volume flood pattern, and everything works just fine. It certainly is possible to use a sub BPD as a multi-instance loop. You just want the first activity to be a user task and not to be a system lane task. And we cover that here in slide 10, the next slide here. So if you look at this particular diagram, this is a good example, and what we're looking at here is not the activity, not the where the multi-instance loop is actually defined, but what is being implemented as a multi-instance loop here, right? So this is effectively the child of the multi-instance loop. And you'll see here that at the start, I'll go to a split, and the tasks that are possible are either are both user tasks. And then following that, there's some system lane post activity, which of course is absolutely fine. Let's move on to slide 11 for a bad example. In the bad example here, the multi-instance loop goes straight to a system lane activity before it does any other processing. If this happens, what you can run into is 1,000 tasks that are spawned to a service engine because you're running a system lane activity, and they get stacked up in the event manager queue. And then when those complete, they get stacked up waiting for their ability to get a free token to move out of the BPD. And you effectively serialize not just the execution of the BPD instance, but you also serialize the event manager as well, because it gets flooded with tasks that it can't complete until the instance has a free token to be able to progress. Next slide, please. Slide number 12. So we have something called conditional joins. There are two main types of joins, a simple join and a conditional join. A simple join is an AND join. For the token to proceed through the join, all lines coming into the join must have an active token. So if you have three lines coming into the join, A, B, and C, you've got to have a token on A, B, and C to be able to progress through the join. And that just makes logical sense. It's sort of the way we all think of joins. But people don't always like to use them, because you can run it. You have some scenarios in your diagram where one of the three lines may not always get a token, and you'll get stuck on the simple join, unable to progress. So the other join you can use is a conditional join. And a conditional join is different. All possible tokens must reach the join before they proceed. So if you have a conditional join with three incoming lines, but only two currently have tokens or could have tokens by looking upstream, then those two tokens must arrive at the join to proceed. So you can it effectively looks upstream from the join to find all of the lines that will ever have an have the ability, in this instance execution, to have a token. And it won't proceed until all those upstream tokens have made it through the join. But if you've got two tokens there already, and it looks upstream, and that third line isn't going to get it, won't ever be able to get a token, then you can proceed through. And that seems great because that makes it less likely that your diagram will get stuck. But there's a catch to it. And let's move on to slide 13 to describe that. When you're using a conditional join, the BPD engine has to look upstream for all possible tokens. And as it moves upstream, it does this by looking up, starts with a fresh, effectively recursive look as it moves up at each one to see what each upstream pattern is. And it turns out this is actually how the BPM spec states we're actually supposed to analyze this. The problem is, if you've got a very, very complex BPD, and my definition of that is if you look at the BPD and it looks like spaghetti and you can't follow it, it probably is too complex, then that recursive upstream look can actually be so computationally expensive it's impossible to complete. So I don't see this very frequently, but it does happen where you see that the BPD won't progress. But if you look at the process monitor, which we'll cover later, you won't actually see anything running. And that's because we're not actually at a step. We're trying to calculate if we should go to a step, if that makes any sense. And it's very CPU expensive because that CPU is burning real hard trying to look upstream at all the possible things that it can do. So what is the net out of all of this? Feel free to use conditional joins, but don't necessarily use them as the default join. And when you do use them, just be cognizant of the fact that if you've got a very complex diagram, it can be expensive to calculate what to do on those conditional joins. Next slide, please. Slide 14. Error handling. This is a classic trap. Global error handling in a service is just plain bad. Just don't use it. If you look at the diagram that we've got pictured here, we've got, you know, a simple service that does some SQL execute and then moves on after that, and then we've got a global error handler here that catches the exception and then displays the error. Seems pretty logical, right? It seems like what you would want to do. The problem with this is that if the display error coach has an error, which is actually surprisingly common, then guess what? It goes back to the catch exception because it's a global exception, catches it, and goes back to display error, which has a failure, back to catch exception, et cetera, and loops forever. And this thread just gets completely clogged and takes the CPU up to 100% as it's looping back and forth. So in general, just don't use global error handlers and services at all, or if you do, be very careful. A common pattern is actually to use them for logging. But let's say your log is log.error, tw.local.error.xpath, and does an xpath on the error. Well, there are cases where you can have an error, and yet the error is null. So when you do tw.local or tw.system.error.xpath, it fails because error is null, and you run into the same problem where it loops and loops and loops and loops. So instead of catching it globally, catch it on the activity if you can, or pass it up to the BPD layer, and then simp, create a user task from that. And in fact, that takes us to our next error handling gotcha, which is error handling in the BPD layer. So next slide, please. A very common pattern that I see in catching errors in a BPD is that you'll have an error handler on an activity that loops back to the same activity. The reasoning being, well, my web service failed, so I want to retry that web service. Well, the problem here is that if it failed, it's probably going to fail again, and it's going to loop over and over and over again. Or even worse, if the failure is either to passing in a variable, like, for instance, you meant to pass in a integer, but you actually passed in a string, or even something as simple as it was meant to go to a certain participant group, and the participant group is poorly defined, then you'll run into a loop. And these loops are insidious because you can't catch them. If you look at the pattern that we've got here, this is actually an activity that's got a system, that's got a service implemented on it. So what's going to happen is you go in, you run the service, it fails. The service throws a failure, so that's in the service engine, the BPD, excuse me, in the service engine. Service engine fails, throws the error back up to the BPD engine. The BPD engine catches the error, sends it back to the service engine again, which then fails, et cetera. So you're actually looping between the BPD engine and the service engine, which is not just causing CPU activity, but it's causing a lot of database activity as you're spawning and processing tasks and saving and loading execution context as you move back and forth between the BPD engine and the service engine. Turns out this is really easy to fix, because there's actually a better pattern for this, and that is that you have your error handlers at the BPD layer go to a task for a user. And I've seen a lot of customers that create a participant lane for what is effectively system administrators so that they see the error and, you know, what's a common thing is, well, wow, the web service is failing. I bet you that let me find out if that web service is down, right? And if it is, they fix it and then send the task back to the failure so that now that they've corrected the problem, it can be retried safely. Next slide, please. Coach performance. We fixed a lot of this in a lot of the releases by improving our client-side JavaScript, but it is a good idea to use custom visibility sparingly, particularly if we're using IE6, because IE6 JavaScript performance is just so absolutely terrible. So you want to try to use as little custom visibility as possible. And you can get around that by using, you know, multiple coaches if you need to or things like that. Really much less of a problem if your company uses more modern browsers. And this is, just to be real specific, this is not server-side evaluation time, but it's actually client-side evaluation time that's affected by the JavaScript that needs to be executed to handle custom visibility. You may want to avoid large, complex coaches. Sometimes the design requires it, but oftentimes you think it does, but it turns out you're better off with just a few simple coaches that interact with each other than one very, very large complex coach. Why not use complex coaches? Well, it takes longer to process because you've got generally a complex coach means that you've got a lot of data that you're processing first. And depending on the browser, there may be some client-side costs in evaluating that as well. And, of course, avoid really large repeating tables, page results instead. I mean, that's actually just plain obvious that if you're trying to display 10,000 rows, it's going to take a while. It's either going to take a while at the server, or it's going to take a while transferring the data to the client, or it'll take a long time for the client to render. So if you got really large result sets, think about paging that data if you can. Next slide. So this is we're on slide 17 right now, and if there's one thing you should pay attention to on this entire activity, it's this particular slide. Sequential system lane activities. I see this all the time. So it's pretty common for people to, when they're creating their BPDs for the first time, to create multiple system lane activities, one after the other. You know, initiate data, you know, call a web service, call an ERP, and then you go to a user task. The problem with that is that each system lane activity is a new event manager task and a new transition back and forth from the service engine to the BPD engine. So if your BPD contains three system lane service tasks in a row, instead, just simply create one system lane task, maybe called init, that wraps the others. So you still have the same programming construct. You've still got three services, but they're nested inside of one service or one system lane activity that the BPD will see. And what happens is event manager lag goes away and performance can improve drastically. This is another change that I've seen where I've seen a BPD that takes literally minutes to start to just take seconds in comparison. It can make a very big difference, particularly depending on how complex the initializations are that you have to do. And I've got an example of that on the next slide here, slide 18. But here's the bad example. So we start a BPD, and then we go to the system lane, and we get some data, we call a web service, we call an ERP, and then we actually, and that's all initialization data, and then we display the task. A better option is the next slide here, slide 19. And what we do here is we do a start, and we go to run init tasks. And init tasks is what's implemented here at the bottom right, and it basically is the same services, right? Get data, call web service, call ERP, just all encapsulated. You have the added bonus that this is actually easier to write the code in because you get to start your service and debug through all of these to make sure everything is working correctly instead of having to debug three individual activities one at a time. So not only is it faster, but it's also easier to write. The one thing that it's not is easier to read because a lot of people like to see all of their 10,000-foot logic in the BPD. Now, I disagree with that. I actually think it's easier to read this way because a common thought is that the BPD is the business logic, the service engine. That's the sort of the IT, that's where the rubber meets the road logic. And a business user doesn't need to see get data, call web service, call ERP. So just, you know, running it tasks makes more sense. So look for these a lot in your solution. If you've got a solution that you're already executing that has these, then the very first thing you should do is get rid of them and compress them all into one activity. The difference will be striking. Okay, slide 20. Java integrations, what we used to call connectors in the 6X days. 6.1 and 7.1 added new SQL and XSL integrations. Use them. They're faster and easier to code with. There were some old ones that came with a toolkit to do things like parameterize SQL, to do parameterize XSL. You really don't want to use those because you can do the same things with the SQL and the XSL Java integrations that we provide now, and they're much faster, and actually better written. A very good example are the SQL connectors will create your business objects for you. So if you have a variable that has an ID and a name, and your SQL has columns that match that variable type, it'll create the variable type for you and do it quickly. 6.1 and 7.1 also fixed a major performance bottleneck where connectors or Java integrations no longer serialize your object to and from strings. Back in the old days, we used to actually, if you're passing back up an XML result set, then like an XML element, then we would actually serialize it to strings first and then back to XML element, which for a lot of data was ridiculously expensive. But it turns out that capability is still there because it's used for Java Bean deserialization, but it's very rarely used. So there's a compatibility flag on the Java integration that allows you to turn that feature on and off. You want to make sure that it's unchecked unless you're doing this really obscure Java Bean deserialization, which nobody uses. So it should be unchecked by default. Anything new that you're developing, it'll be unchecked by default. If you grab some stuff from a toolkit or somebody, you get something off the community that's an old asset, it may come in with the compatibility flag checked. Move on to slide 21. If you're writing a new Java integration, pretty common for people to use toString to pass objects to a Java and then they serialize and deserialize them. It's really a bad idea because creating a string from a large object is expensive. It costs CPU time, it costs heap time. You're far better off, particularly since variables already have a nice XML representation, to just pass it in as an XML element. So you would do tw.local.myvar.2xml, and it'll, instead of 2xml, 2-string true, which is the string version, and your Java can receive it. It's actually if you're writing the Java integration, you will use a JDOM element as your parameter. And you can use that for not just passing values in, but also for passing values out. You can also use the same technique if you want to create a variable in your connector that would be used as your typical business variable in your BPD or in your service. What you do is you create the XML, and then in the step after your Java integration, you use a tw.system.serializer.fromxml to create the actual business object. So it gives you a very simple way to create service and BPD variables in your Java integrations. You just build the XML using JDOM, which, if you ever use JDOM, is ridiculously easy, and then use the serializer to convert that XML into an actual object. Also, Live Connect is very, very bad. Some of you may not even know what Live Connect is. Live Connect is something that exists in browsers and exists for us server-side as well, where you can call Java directly from JavaScript. It's very convenient. It makes life easy in some cases, but it turns out to be very, very bad because of the way we have to interact with Live Connect. We still have to take variables and convert them to and from strings to call Java from Live Connect. So if you've got a 5-meg XML element, you would think that if you called your class via Live Connect that it would pass it as XML element, but it actually doesn't. It goes XML element string back to XML element again. So you're better off to use to use Java integrations directly. Slide 22. Next slide, please. The process monitor. So the process monitor is a big thing when you're authoring for performance. For those of you that are Unix folks, it's like Unix top for the process server. It's per JVM. It's not cluster-wide. And it allows you to go to the JVM and see what's actually being executed on that JVM at that particular time. And it doesn't, and it's actually, it'll tell you whether or not you're, it's, because services, if it's at a coach, isn't really executing. It's just waiting, right? So if it says that there's an active service, it's actually a service that's burning CPU or waiting on a database. I mean, it's got a thread that's being consumed on the server at any particular time. You can also kill runaway services as long as that service is transitioning from one step to the next, because its opportunity to halt is when it moves from one step to the next. And you can see how long it takes for services to run. So if you want to have an idea of where your costs are and how long different steps are taking and things like that, you can use the process monitor to be able to do that. If we look at the next slide here, which is a slide 23, you'll see a simple example here. There's a summary tab, a processes tab, and a services tab. What we're looking at here is this, we have clicked on an individual service from the summary tab or from the services tab, and this is the details on that individual service. So you've got the name and its instance ID, and right now it's inactive slash completed, so that means that this service is no longer doing any work. And then it lists not all the steps, because this is an in-memory thing. We don't hold the ball, but the more expensive ones and how often they were run, et cetera. Next slide, slide 25. Another very useful screen is the instrumentation monitor. Now, the instrumentation monitor is actually the allows you to look at Teamwork's internals, and there's a page that will give you even more detail than the stock one, and I list the URL here. This is a view into the APIs that the system is using. And so, and it's actually surprisingly easy to use, particularly if you can quiesce the system. So let's say you've got a service that you know is executing slow, and you don't know why. So try to get everybody else off the system and first execute that service and look at it in the process monitor. And if you can see that, oh, I've got a step in here where I'm calling the database, and that's taking 15 seconds, well, you're pretty much done. You know that you need to look at the database and see where your performance is. But if, on the other hand, it's taking 30 seconds, and that 30 seconds is not being reflected in the process monitor, then it's probably some API that's taking a long time. And you can go into the instrumentation monitor, and you can clear the monitor, and then, or actually you can just, you can hit, I think you can flush it, but anyway, you can view it, run your service, and then click refresh. And all the values that have changed will show up in green, and you can use those to look at those services and say, oh, well, look at this. When we make this call, there's a 20-second delay to the user org module for forget groups. I wonder, oh, well, look at this. The group this service is actually makes a call to get the membership of a group. This is an LDAP group. It has 1,000 members. I wonder if it's actually LDAP that we're waiting on. So you can use the instrumentation monitor to look a little bit deeper into the time that's being spent. And it also has things like the save execution context time is in there. There's some 7x WLE stuff related to versioning that can be kind of interesting. It's just a very useful page if you need to dive in deep. Both the process monitor and the instrumentation monitor are available to you from slash Teamworks, which I think is the, now they call it the process admin console. Slide 25. So here's an actual example of the instrumentation monitor here. So we're looking at in this particular case, it's the user org module class, and then the different methods, get current username, get ID from principal name, and these are all calls that represent calls to get user information. And as an example here, we can see that we called get current username 490,000 times, but the average duration was less than a tenth of a millisecond, so it's very, very, very quick. And there's some other here where, like, we've got get roles, we did 128 times, but it took 113 milliseconds each, right? Or you get user member of is even more interesting, because that was there's 73.4 is the average duration, but it took 208 total seconds of execution time as it went through all of that stuff. Slide 26, next slide. Tasks in the portal inbox. So if you've got any install that's over four to 6 months old in production, you need to make sure that you are archiving old completed instances. And you want to do that because you don't want the database to grow unbounded, right? It makes sense that if you're doing, 100,000 instances a week, that the database will just grow and grow and grow and grow. So most people don't actually need completed instances anymore because they don't do you a great deal of good. You report off of them based off of the data that's in the performance server. That doesn't go away, but you can't bring up a completed instance and do anything with it in the process inspector. You can't run tasks on it anymore, et cetera. So they do you almost no good to still be around. So if you look at the tech note that we list here in the talk, there's a stored procedure that ships with the product, LSW BPD instance delete, that will delete an instance and all of its associated tasks and some other carry-on data as well. So you could, the tech note gives you more detail on this, but you can query for all closed instances that are, say, over 30 days old and delete those instances. And that can make a big difference for long-term performance of the system because you don't have to deal a lot with the maintaining the database cost of a large database. They can also make a big difference for portal inbox searches because portal inbox searches need to query not just all the tasks but all of and all the instances, but all of the instance variables. So if you're doing 100,000 instances a month, that could be a tremendous amount of data, and I don't care how optimized the SQL is or how optimized the system is, it can be expensive to maintain those things. So deleting closed instances can make a big difference in the long-term performance of your system. Another thing that you can do that helps is if you've got system lane tasks, there are two ways that you can call system lane tasks. The default actually creates a task when it runs a system lane task. So if you look at an instance after it's run, you'll see a whole bunch of closed tasks for system lane tasks. That actually creates an entry in LSW task and all the other sort of the background data, much like one would have for a user task. Well, there is an option called service no task. Under the implementation for the activity, you can say service no task. And that does actually create a task, but it deletes it right afterwards. And that can help a little bit with how much data is there. Oddly enough, there's a cost in having to delete the task after you create it. So there's a bit of a trade-off there, but it certainly helps keep the database a little bit tighter by not having those tasks around. And the only valid reason to have a system lane task is if there's a failure, you can rerun the task. Although generally, if there's a failure, the task has failed and you can resume it and it still works. But I've seen some scenarios where having the task is useful. Another thing you can do to help portal inbox search is don't have large amounts of business data, right? So if you have a BPD that has 10 variables that are listed as searchable, then that means for every instance, you're going to create 10 instance variables. So in the scenario where we had 100,000 a month, that's a million a month. That's an awful lot. So limit business data search to only those fields that you know you're actually going to use to filter tasks in the portal. The other thing is that I've seen customers where the portal inbox, if you look at it, has 2,000 tasks in it. Well, no one can go through 2,000 tasks. And that just doesn't work. Right, I mean, as an end user, that would be untenable, right? So try to find ways to make it so that the task list that a user sees is more appropriate to their job and is an actual list that they have the ability to complete and to work through. Some ways to do that are there's some pretty interesting routing features in the BPD, like you can load balance to individual users. You may be able to create smaller groups that you can route tasks to, et cetera. Let's move on to slide 27. So this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. You can visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Technical Support Exchange webcasts like the one you attended today and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. Visit websphereusergroup.org for user group information and for more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notification link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates and products of interest to you. Slide 28. We, of course, want to hear from you. So if you have any suggestions about this webcast or any further ones, feel free to drop us a line. And last but not least, question and answers. So I think Joseph is going to open up for questions, and I'll be happy to answer whatever questions you may have.
Right. So thank you, David, for a wonderful presentation. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Our first question comes from Vivi Kanis. Your line is open.
Hi, David. I had one question about this coaches. Like you mentioned about the performance seat where we design the coaches too complex. But just consider the scenario we have a scenario where we have to reuse the coaches across all the activities. So I just wanted to know how much factoring you will give to the complexity of the JavaScript and all the custom coding is included in the code so that it can be reused. I mean, are simple coaches better to reuse in multiple steps, or it's generally avoided? I mean, I just want to get your views on that.
It's kind of hard to come up with a really great general answer to that because it's always such a dependent answer. I guess you're reusing them because you basically have a service that wraps the coach, and you pass in common data or something like that, so you find yourself calling it an awful lot. That sometimes a little bit of a performance hit is worth it for that level of reuse. If your solution is one where you've got a lot of common coaches, it makes a lot of sense to have them all come up in a similar way. I guess my answer to that one is, if you've got a performance problem, try to see, am I seeing it on the server side or am I seeing it on the client side? And if it's on the client side, then it may relate to the JavaScript cost, and you may have to think about ways to reduce that. And if it's on the server side, then what is all the preamble that I'm doing, and is there a way that I can, tighten that up so it doesn't take as long to gather up that data before displaying the code?
Okay, so for the server side, you're stating that it would be better if we can organize our data in a better manner so that there is not too much of a calculation or a CPU hit, something like that.
Yeah, once again, that's very, very hard to tell because it depends. Sometimes you have to go to the database to get a whole bunch of data, and databases are really fast. I mean, I've seen people try to over-engineer this. In fact, I over-engineered a solution a few years ago by putting in a whole bunch of caching and all this other stuff, and I realized later how incredibly stupid that was because I spent all this effort and saved I saved 50 milliseconds, right? It absolutely wasn't worth it, when it was all in the database, right? So, I mean, I think hopefully you can use some of the tools that I showed you, like the process monitor and the instrumentation monitor, and then just, common sense as you're looking through your solution that if you have performance issues, you would know. And the other thing I should bring up that I don't really bring up in this talk, but you reminded me of very well there, is that you cannot substitute good load testing. It is absolutely vital that even if you're only going to launch to 10 users, that you've got some level of load testing. And you need that just so that you can have confidence that your solution is ready to move to production. But you also need that so that if you do believe you have found a performance problem, you can test whether or not the solution that you've come up with actually works, right? So it's very important to have load testing. The other thing you should make sure of is that your environment is tuned for production. We don't really talk about it in this talk, and I don't know if we have one scheduled or not, but it turns out not to be all that complicated. If you just look for a tune runtime, tune Lombardi tune runtime performance, you'll see a tech note that's out there for tuning your environment. And if it's taking you 15 seconds to display your coach and you're not tuned, if you do the 8 or 10 things that are on that web page, you probably can take it down from 15 seconds to 5.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for that. You mentioned that there should always be a good load testing for this. Do you recommend any specific tools, or methodologies, which will help me out on this point?
Yeah, whichever one you know how to use. It doesn't matter.
I haven't been into the load testing and stuff.
I think IBM may have some products. JMeter works, right? It just needs to be something that's automated, right? It's not a load test if you bring 10 users in and have them click, right? Because you can't get a baseline. You can't measure improvement from a whole bunch of people showing in a room and clicking. So any level of automated testing is useful. You guys are going to have me talk for hours. So the 7.5 is just around the corner, and 7.5 introduces the REST API. And the REST API is really an amazing tool because it allows you to not just start a service like our web API does, but actually interact with the coaches within a service. And so 7.5, with a little bit of coding, you could actually write a unit test that calls the service just like a user does, without actually having to ever display a coach. So you can go through a full you could automate your testing in a way that we've never been able to do before. So I know that's a bit of an aside, but something that when I saw the REST API, I realized was an interesting implementation of the REST API that I think other people hadn't thought of before.
David, any more views on the caching part? Because we are also trying out something similar.
I really believe caching is ridiculous.
Okay,
the only scenario I've seen that makes any sense at all is if you need to call an external web service to get data for a coach, and that external web service keeps returning the same data and takes a long time to return. And in that scenario, I would simply just basically clone the data from the web service and put it in a database and just grab it from the database. Right? Because databases are just so fast. Right?
Oh.
But trying to do complex Java-based caching is just, I've never really seen it have the value versus the cost of making it in the first place.
Okay. So progressively we should shift from web service. I mean, what all, redundant data the web service keeps returning the same data. Probably we should shift it back to the database. So that the cost is less for accessing it a second time.
Right. But the other side of that is that you want to make sure that you actually have a problem before you fix the problem, right?
Yeah.
So that's what tuning and load testing may show you, that it actually performs better than you thought, right?
Okay.
So before you go down the road of doing caching, that's why you need load testing, right? You need to make sure you have a problem in the first place. Because it just doesn't make sense to solve the problem. Because let's face it, WLE is all about solving the business problem, right? And so sometimes that means, as IT people, we have to realize that we're focusing often on the wrong things. And high-speed caching is not focusing on the business problem, right? It's actually a blocker to getting a solution live. The best WLE implementations I've ever seen are those where you scope the solution small so that you can launch the product in 30 days. And then you use the fact, particularly now that 7's got such nice versioning, to incrementally improve things as you go. Right. So we should probably open up to some other questions. So if you don't mind, we can move on to anyone else that may have questions out there.
Sure, Dave. Thanks.
Thank you. The great questions.
Our next question comes from Paramesh Thambattu. Your line is open.
Hi, David. This is Paramesh Thambattu from Alliance Life. And my question is there any performance factor to be considered while using sub-BPDs?
No, not at all. That's a great question. Except in the scenario of multi-instance lists that I gave you there, nested BPDs, and for that matter, nested services, have virtually no cost. I actually did some tests about that where I went 1,000 layers deep, and it didn't affect anything at all. So, no, you're absolutely fine.
All right. Thank you.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please dial *1 at this time.
So while we wait for the questions to come in, David, I do have a question here coming in for you from the web conference group chat. And the question is, could you please let me know where I could get the Lombardi trial version, because we are planning to migrate BPM from Wood to Lombardi.
Yeah, I actually don't know the answer to that. I know that your salesperson can. There's the 7.5 is due out any day now, and I believe that that they have an express edition, but I don't know if it's a demo version or not. You'll definitely need to contact your salesperson and ask them.
Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no further questions on the phone.
Since we do not have any other questions, we will conclude the presentation at this point in time.